Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. We're only a few days away from the full moon of May, which is the Vesak celebration, the time when we traditionally remember the birth, the enlightenment, and the passing away of the Buddha. Because we're not yet at Vesak, I'm going to give a teaching tonight based on the time just before the Buddha became enlightened. This particular teaching centers around the Buddha establishing his seat at the foot of the Bodhi tree. Not yet the Bodhi tree, because he hadn't yet become enlightened, just the fig tree. Those of you who might be familiar with the story of the Buddha will know that for 6 years he practiced ascetic practices, great austerities, in which he deprived the body of nourishment, of food, and did all sorts of very strenuous practices, trying to subdue the body to make the mind peaceful. And eventually he realized that wasn't the way to go, and so he started to take nourishment again, to go on arms round and take food. And then on the morning before he made his great effort, he was offered milk rice by one of the young women of the area, Sujata, who was making an offering out of gratitude for the birth of her first child, a son. And that offering of milk rice is remembered as the last meal that the Bodhisatta, the enlightened being-to-be, took before he sat at the root of the Bodhi tree and made the determination that he would sit, and even if his blood dried up and his sinews rotted, that he wouldn't move until he attained enlightenment. And when the Buddha took up his seat at the foot of the Bodhi tree and prepared for his last great struggle, Mara, the tempter, came along to challenge the Buddha's right to make the push for enlightenment. And Mara came with his armies and challenged the Buddha, saying to him, "Who do you think you are to be sitting there saying that you're going to sit there until you become enlightened? What credentials do you have that give you the right to make that kind of aspiration?" And I think the Buddha's answer to Mara is one that is extremely powerful as a teaching for all of us. Because the Buddha's reply to Mara was that what gave him the right to sit there, where his credentials came from, was that throughout the course of countless lifetimes, he had cultivated and perfected the paramis, the 10 perfections, the 10 qualities of goodness. When I reread this story recently, it actually surprised me. It stunned me to be reminded that what the Buddha said gave him the right to sit there was the power of goodness that he had accumulated. We might think that it must be because he's so wise already, or because he's done so much meditation and he's almost there, or that he's practiced all these austerities, he's really given it all he's got. And so that would be what he would say gave him the right to sit there. But no, he said it's because of the power of goodness that I've developed over countless lifetimes. And this power of goodness, the 10 perfections, this will be my shield and my weapon against you, Mara, and your armies trying to dislodge me from this seat. These 10 perfections aren't abstract qualities. They're not metaphysical concepts. They're qualities like generosity, morality, loving kindness, patience, determination, truthfulness, energy. They're very human qualities. And this is what stunned me when I read this passage again, that what the Buddha was using as the foundation for his last thrust towards enlightenment was the power of goodness that he had accumulated throughout his countless lifetimes. We talk about virtue, morality, a good life being the cornerstone of the spiritual life, and has as the necessary foundation for whatever practices we develop as we go along. And in the Noble Eightfold Path, which the Buddha taught after his enlightenment, this Noble Eightfold Path has three sections, and one of them is sila, morality. The other two are samadhi, the cultivation of the mind in meditation, and panya, wisdom. And although we hear again and again that sila, morality, is indispensable for progress on the path and is in fact one of the foundation practices that we need to accomplish in order to get our spiritual practices going, we can still very easily minimize the importance of the power of goodness in giving us the stamina, the collateral, if you like, the credibility to proceed with the path. And so the fact that the Buddha was using his accomplishments in goodness as the demonstration of his right to practice for enlightenment, his right to challenge Mara, makes a very important and I think very powerful lesson for all of us. When the Buddha was challenged by Mara and he said that he had completed these 10 perfections throughout many lifetimes, Mara said, "Oh yeah, so have I. I've been very generous." And Mara turned to all of his lackeys, members of his army, and said, "Haven't I been very generous? Won't you all say that I've been very generous?" And all of his soldiers, all of those forces of negativity, backed him up and said, yeah, yes, you've been very generous, Mara, yes, whatever you say. And the Buddha said, here I sit all alone. I have no mother, no father, no relatives, no friend, no sentient beings here to back up my claim that I have completed these perfections. So I call on the earth to bear witness to the fact that I have perfected the power of goodness. I don't have anyone here, but may the earth be my witness. And he reached out his hand and touched the earth, and the earth shook. And Mara realized that there was no way that he was going to dislodge the Buddha from his enlightenment seat. Not the Buddha yet, sorry, the Bodhisatta, from his enlightenment seat, because the strength of his goodness was beyond reproach. It provided the refuge, it provided the shield, it provided the weapon that even Mara couldn't overcome with all of his armies. And so the Buddha continued to sit throughout the night, and when the morning star appeared, he had developed his mind to the point where he was fully enlightened. Now I'd like to tie this teaching in with another very powerful experience, and that is the experience of facing our death and the power of goodness to provide a refuge for us as we face our death. Because at the time that we face our death, we will be just like the Buddha. No mother, no father, no relative, no friend. No one can do our death for us, even if they're standing or sitting right next to us. All that we have as our refuge, as our shield, if you like, is what we have accumulated within our own mind. And when we face our death, it's at that point that we only have that to call on. Again, we can underestimate the power of a good life to provide a refuge at that time. That's why I am trying to tie this teaching in with the power of goodness to support the Buddha's quest for enlightenment, so that none of us underestimates the power of goodness to provide a refuge even at the most drastic times of our life. To have that refuge, we have to live a good life. And all of the perfections which the Buddha nominated to Mara as being his credentials for pursuing enlightenment, for not being moved from his enlightenment seat, these are all things that any of us can develop. We're not talking about esoteric practices or metaphysical truths which can't be known and can't be lived out in our life. Generosity, loving kindness, truthfulness, energy, determination. All of these qualities are things which we can actively develop, that we can put into practice and that we can grow. We might just take one of them and make it a focus. Patience, for example, kanti. This is something which we need in our relationships with others. We need it in our relationship to ourself. We need it in our meditation. How patient can we be just watching the breath again and again and again? How patient can we be with the mind when it keeps running all over the place? How patient can we be with the person sitting near us who's making a noise and disturbing us? Patience is a quality which is a real virtue, not only because it helps us get on with others, but because it brings peace and stability into our own mind. When we're facing our death, to know that we've lived a good life provides tremendous support for the mind. It allows us to be more accepting. It allows us to retain energy in the mind. It allows us to frequently find that recollection of our goodness as a place where we can go to be at peace even when the body is giving us a hard time. We may not recognize how much of a support this would be as we face our death until we start to think about how upset we might get when our body's not doing what we expect it to do, when it's aches and pains. Just when we're sitting in meditation, how easy is it for us to let go of that body and go to the peace of the mind? One of the ways we can establish peace in the mind when the mind isn't very peaceful is to bring up remembrance of the good that we've done. Bring up the remembrance of times of helpfulness to others, of generosity, of kindness. This can be a tremendous balm for the mind. And when the mind is soothed, it can help the body to calm down. Even if we're not on our deathbed, but we're facing a life-threatening illness, it can also be a tremendous support to recollect the goodness of our life. Someone came to the monastery a while ago who was very frightened of death. And they were saying that they were very frightened of death because they have young children. And they're afraid that they're going to die and leave their children behind. But on the other hand, they said, they'd just been to visit an elderly relative in an aged care institution. And when they saw the people there, some of them with dementia and some of them with very broken down bodies, they said they were afraid that they might live for a long time and then they might end up in one of those institutions. And so they didn't only have fear of death, they had fear of living a long time. They just had a lot of fear. And when we were talking about this, there happened to be someone in the group who was actually facing a very serious illness, a life-threatening illness. And I turned to that person and I asked them, without saying anything about their illness, did they have anything to add or anything to offer to this person, because they'd practiced for a very long time. And they said to the person who was afraid of dying or of living, they said, "The thing that is a great help to me is to know that I haven't spent my life running after trinkets. I've spent my life in a very good way." And they didn't go into detail talking about all the good things that they'd done, but from the way that they answered, they knew the good that they'd done. And they frequently rejoiced in the good that they had done. And that was a source of strength for them. That was a source of refuge for them. The fact that their life was likely to be shorter rather than longer was something that they accepted, knowing that they had made best use of the time that they had. When we are facing the end of our life, sometimes it's difficult to remember the good things that we've done because the mind is full of fear, full of anxiety. And so it can be very helpful if someone's there to remind us of the good that we've done, to mention the acts of kindness, the acts of selfless service, the acts of generosity. It can be a great comfort for the relatives of those who are sick and dying to be able to easily bring up into their mind instances of this person's goodness. Because one of the things that arises as we face our death is fear of the pain, but also fear of where we're going to go once we die. If we've lived a good life, if we've created a lot of good karma, then there's much less fear, especially if there's confidence in the Buddha's teaching that we're reborn according to the quality of our mind. And the quality of our mind reflects the kind of life that we've led. And it's a comfort for the person who's dying, and it's also a comfort for their relatives and dear ones who are trying to help their dear one to die peacefully. So if we think that we love the people around us and we really want to make life easy for them, one of the things that we can do is to live a good life so that we face our death fearlessly. Then the people who are saying goodbye to us and who have to face our departure from this life have much less worry, much less anxiety, because they know, even if they have to say goodbye, that their loved one is sure to go to a good place. Being able to rejoice in the goodness of someone's life actually helps to support the hearts of those who are losing their dear ones. And this is something that we can all do for the people that we love. Lead a good life so they don't have to worry about us when we're dying. Doesn't mean that they're happy to see us go or that we're happy to go, but there's much more peace, much more acceptance in that. If we've lived a good life at the time of our death, that's where we put our attention. And our energy isn't sucked away, isn't wasted, worrying about the things that we've done or haven't done, should have done but didn't do. None of that needs to arise in the mind because we have done the very best we could with the conditions that we had in our life. And this is the power of goodness to allow us to be at peace. The other refuge that we have at the time of our death is the wisdom that we've been able to develop throughout the course of our life and throughout our spiritual practice. And the wisdom from the Buddha's teaching, the wisdom aspect, is the recognition that everyone dies, that everything that arises comes to an end. We might have heard this many, many times, but do we really believe it yet? And do we really believe that it means me? Have we contemplated our own death and seen where we resist it? What keeps us saying no to it? What keeps us hanging on? What are we hanging on to? Who are we hanging on to? When we hear the teaching that this body doesn't belong to us, doesn't belong to me, it's a part of nature and it will follow its own nature When it's ready, it will cease functioning. It doesn't matter how wealthy we are, how clever we are. It doesn't matter what medical technology has to offer to us. One day the body will stop. Do we really accept that? Do we really understand that? Have we really come to terms with that? When we reflect on it, we hear all of the yes but, oh no, the resistance. And that's where we start to look. Where does that resistance come from? What's it founded on? Is it based in truth? However much we've cultivated this kind of reflection and practice in our meditation to be able to let go and to see things as they are, not according to our wishes and hopes, see reality, that much wisdom will be available to support us at the time of our death. But one of the things that wisdom needs as a support, unless we're fully enlightened, is it needs some strength and clarity of mind at the time of death. Otherwise, all the wisdom, unless it's very strong wisdom, is likely to be overshadowed by the difficulties of dying. All the interventions, all of the disturbances in the environment, the people talking, the noise that's going on, the routine of the hospital that we're not used to or doesn't suit us. Maybe we're going to die in a supermarket and all the trolleys rattling around us. Who knows? One of the points to understand is that our mind at the time of death may not be able to focus so well. And this again is where the power of goodness comes in. Because the power of goodness and the ability to take refuge in our goodness helps the mind to calm down. It helps the mind to let go of the exterior. It helps the mind to let go of what's happening in the body. Let someone else take care of that. It allows us to go into that quiet place where the wisdom that we've touched on, that we've glimpsed, that we may have developed throughout the course of our life is able to be accessed. Now again, it may require someone to remind us. We might hear the words of the Buddha recited or chanted or read to us. We might have someone reminding us this is just the nature of the body. It's no big deal. This is just death. But how can we hear that? How can we pay attention? How can we let go at that time? If we've cultivated the power of goodness, then we've also cultivated the stability and tranquility of mind that that gives rise to. And it's that tranquility, that ability to access the calm, clear, strong mind that allows us to hear the words of wisdom and to reconnect with the wisdom that we know to be the truth. When it comes to the time of death, we may still be worrying about those who we're leaving behind, like the lady who was worried about dying because she was going to be leaving her young family behind. How can we let go of that at the time of death? How can we focus in on what we need to do for ourselves? The wisdom that we've heard again and again and again. Each one of us is the owner of our own karma. This is our closest relative. This is what supports us in this life and into the next life. If we've lived a good life, if we've looked after our family well, if we've given them good guidance, been good role models, shown them the right way to live, done what we could to establish them in the power of goodness, then how much easier it is at that time to know that we've done all we could do for them. Now it's time to fully focus on ourselves. Now all of this is only words unless we put it into practice. Having been with people who are dying and having seen the power of goodness to be a refuge and a support for them, the power of goodness to allow them to access the wisdom that they know in order to let go, in order to face death, I know that it is a tremendous support. I know that it can provide the refuge that we need at that time, which no one else can provide for us. But we have to do the work ourselves. And so I encourage you all to reflect on the story of the Buddha. Before his enlightenment, when challenged by Mara, who do you think you are to be sitting here striving for enlightenment? The Buddha said, my credentials are that I have cultivated the 10 perfections. I sit on the power of goodness. So may all of you establish yourselves in the power of goodness, and may it help all of you to continue to cultivate the path to enlightenment. And particularly tonight, I would like to dedicate the merits of tonight's teaching to our good friend Ron Battersby, who passed away last week, who was a wonderful example of someone who had the power of goodness and the power of wisdom as his refuge and his shield throughout his life and also at the time of his death. So may the merit of this teaching help us all on our journey. May it help us all to attain Nibbana, and may it certainly help Ron on his journey. May it help him to attain Nibbana. So does anyone have any comments or questions they'd like to make? The question was, how much difference is it likely to make if you slip up at the last crucial moment? Well, we can see in this the stories from the Tipitaka that there were cases of people who did slip up at the last moment, and they had a very short, unfavourable rebirth before the power of their goodness took over. So one of the examples is Emperor Ashoka, who few hundred years after the time of the Buddha was instrumental in the spread of Buddhism throughout the whole of India, and also the spread of Buddhism throughout Southeast Asia, and did a tremendous amount of work supporting monasteries, and his son and his daughter became enlightened, his grandchildren became enlightened, and he was did tremendous good karma. But it's said that at the time of his death, that being the king, he had many wives, and at the time of his death, when he was on his deathbed, one of the wives that he didn't like came into the chamber to see him as he was dying, and he got very angry at the sight of seeing her, and he died with that thought in his mind. And so he was reborn in the animal realm for a short time, for a week, and then after that bad karma had finished, he received the fruits of the good karma that he'd done. So that was an example of someone slipping up at the last moment, but it doesn't negate the power of goodness that's there. The power of goodness means that the fruiting of the bad karma is very short-lived, and the experience of the fruits of the good karma comes straight afterwards. And the power of good karma is said to fruit first, But in the case where it's something at the instant of death, then it has effect, but it doesn't last for long. So one of the ways of testing out the power of goodness in our lives is just see the effect that it has on our life as we live it. How peaceful it is to be living a good life. How much dis-ease it brings into the mind when we go off the rails. And we might find pleasure in going off the rails, but we also know that we pay a price for it. So overindulgence in anything, just that kind of going off the rails, always comes at a price. If we use the five precepts as our guidelines, then if we try just to live within those five precepts, it gives us tremendous scope for enjoying ourselves and having a good time, for making the most of our material prosperity and all that sort of thing. But it also provides us with limitations so that we don't get carried away by our desire, our greed, or our ill will and our jealousy. And this way we live a much more even kind of life. It is better for the mind and better for the body. And then we also see the effect of the power of goodness on our relationships with others. When we are living a good life, it smooths things out. It becomes our habit to get on with others. And when we're not getting on with them, it feels terrible, and so we make an effort to try to improve our relationships. So it's tremendously helpful for our own sake and also for the sake of those that we share our lives with. Those people who live only one life, well, in Buddhism we don't accept that there is just one life. The understanding is that we've all lived many lifetimes before, and until we are free of the wish to be, the craving to be, in Pali, the bhava tanha, then we're going to be reborn again and again. It's not up to us. We can't just stop it by wishing it. We have to remove the conditions for rebirth. And the condition for rebirth is craving, wanting to be born, wanting to be. And because of our ignorance, we don't know how to create the kind of life that brings happiness. So the Buddha's teaching is about showing us how to live well, how through our deliberate thought, speech and action we can create a good life for ourselves. That's what practicing the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, is about. And even if we live a good life, our craving to be isn't completely overcome. That's why we have to not only live a good life but actively cultivate the development of the mind in meditation, so that we can start to go deeper into this craving, into understanding it and dealing with it, and the wisdom aspect of the path, which allows us to understand what it is, where it comes from, and how to deal with it. So we get lots of chances. That's one of the nice things about it. We may not do it completely successfully this time, but if we've created the conditions, then we'll be able to have good opportunities in the next life. So if there are no more questions, I think we'll have an early mark tonight, and I'll hand over to Sol. Thank you, Sol.